Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. We ended up last week with verse 36, which ended the Mount of Transfiguration. And so, as we pick up here with verse 37 of Luke 9, Jesus and the core three apostles, Peter, James, and John, are coming off of the Mount of Transfiguration, and there is a big crowd of Israelites down here with the other nine apostles. And there is, unfortunately, a little issue that has arisen. So we'll pick up here with Luke 9, verse 37. Now it happened on the next day when they, and this they is Jesus, Peter, Andrew, Peter, James, and John, they had come down from the mountain that a great multitude met him. Suddenly a man from the multitude cried out, saying, "Teacher, I implore you, look on my son, for he is my only child." And behold, a spirit seizes him and suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth, and it departs from him with great difficulty, bruising him. So I implored your disciples to cast it out, but they could not. Okay, this kind of aggravates Jesus a little bit, or maybe not so little bit. He's disappointed in these other nine that they can't do this. I'll go ahead and read Jesus' comment here, but now, his disgust is not only with the nine, it's also with these Israelite multitude that's at the base of this mountain. 41, then Jesus answered and said, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." So, he's disgusted that the nine cannot cast him out. In Matthew and Mark's account, we're told that Jesus, and Luke leaves this part out, but Jesus tells them that this kind requires prayer and fasting. So, what Kaufman's thought about his rethinking of why they could not the nine could not cast out the demon out of this child is that they were thinking that this power was coming from them only and not coming from God. And so the mistake that they forgot was praying to God, since that was the only place that this power is going to come from. So that is why they thought that this power was coming from them. They were obviously getting too arrogant, and they needed to petition God in prayer in order to cast out this demon. And then also with this comment, "O faithless and perverse generation," there's also some doubt of this man that, well, your apostles couldn't cast out my son's demon, can you? And so doubt there, and then obviously doubt throughout the crowd, which we already know from the previous accounts in Luke, plus the previous accounts in Matthew and Mark, that these Pharisees have already had a pretty successful defamation campaign against Jesus in order to get the people to start questioning, and they've been so successful questioning whether Jesus is the Messiah or not, that when Jesus asked the apostles, "Who do the people say that I am?" the Messiah never came up. So this doubt has really risen, and so that explains this statement, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you and bear with you?" Okay, so verse 42, "And as he was still coming, the demon threw the boy down and convulsed him. Then Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the child, and gave him back to his dad. Okay, so Jesus, of course, had no trouble casting out this unclean spirit that was plaguing this child. But this was a learning experience, is definitely what this was for these apostles. Verse 43, "And they were all amazed at the majesty of God, but while everyone marveled at all the things which Jesus did, he said to his disciples, let these words sink down into your ears, for the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men." So, this is the second time that he's told them this. He told the apostles before he went, when he was in Caesarea Philippi, up here, on his way to the Mount of Transfiguration, he told them for the first time that he was going to be killed. And now he's come down off of the mountain, and he's telling the apostles again the same thing to let them know. But we get a little bit more insight right here in verse 45. "But they did not understand this saying, and it was hidden from them so that they did not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about this saying." Now, Kaufman's thought is that this was not God hiding this understanding from them, but it was a failure of mankind as a whole as far as why they did not understand, because this having a supreme being to offer himself as a sin sacrifice for the sins of man is a very difficult thing to understand for man, and that's why they did not comprehend all of this. Because it's a very deep concept. Plus, God had not revealed his plan of salvation to mankind yet. Jesus is just slowly bringing this out a little at a time. But all through the Old Testament, they knew there was going to be a Messiah, and they knew that he was going to reign over a kingdom, and then God's kingdom was going to last forever. So they knew that much from Daniel, Isaiah, other prophecies, Joel. But they did not have a full grasp, because God had kept secret, or kept it a mystery, about the full plan of salvation. So that is Kaufman's explanation, that this was not God that made it to where they couldn't understand it, but it was just their human human limitations that kept them from fully perceiving what Jesus was talking about, sacrificing himself for the sins of all of mankind. Okay, now these apostles are going to have an arrogancy rise again. Their egos are going to get too big here, which you would have thought that they would have already gotten that in check, since they could not cast out this demon out of this young child, this boy. But it doesn't. Okay, verse 46. "Then a dispute arose among them as to which of them would be the greatest. And Jesus, perceiving the thought of their heart, took a little child and set him by him, and said to them, Whoever receives this little child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you all will be great." So, and Jesus says in the other records of the other accounts of the gospel that the kingdom of God is not going to be like the kingdom of men. In fact, it's going to be completely the opposite. It's going to be tilted on its head. Here on the kingdoms of men, the greatest are the rulers, and then the lowest are the low workers. But this is going to be the opposite. in God's kingdom. It's going to be the lowly workers are going to be the greatest in God's kingdom, and those that are great are going to be the least. So this is also one of these revealings about God's kingdom that had never been given or explained or told to mankind. But Jesus is revealing clues about God's kingdom, a little here and a little there, and not hitting them with everything all at once. But this is another teaching tool, and unfortunately, all these denominational religions, most all, have completely ignored this, and they still think that the greatest are going to be the greatest, and they uphold great instead of all Christians on a level playing field. They never got that thought. Verse 49. Now John answered and said, "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he does not follow us." But Jesus said to him, "Do not forbid him, for he who is not against us is on our side." Now, who is this, and where did he come from? Where is he getting this power? See, this is all confusing, which it could be definitely confusing to us too, but it's confusing to these apostles. Well, this is what we know. Number one, only the power of God can cast out the demons. Jesus has already addressed this in Matthew chapter 12 when the Pharisees came and made a false accusation against Jesus that he was casting out demons by the power of Satan and that he had allied himself with Satan. Jesus easily disputed that by saying, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." So, we know that whoever this was did not get his power from Satan. He's getting this power from God, which was obviously given to him through Jesus, just like the apostles got this power. Before Jesus came on the earth, there was no one to cast out any of these demons. And now, Jesus gave in the first of this chapter, gave the apostles the power to cast out demons, and obviously unbeknownst to the apostles, he gave this man also, and they have run into him. The apostles were not always with Jesus. In fact, at the first of this chapter 9, Jesus sent out the 12 two by two, and they were gone sometime away from Jesus. So obviously that was a prime time that Jesus didn't just sit around doing nothing. He was still working, so obviously that we can infer and probably maybe even necessarily infer that that is where this man came from. When Jesus had sent these 12 out, they knew nothing about what he was doing. He was going and teaching other disciples, and this was one of the men that he gave the power to cast out demons. Okay, now, and this man is not the only one. Here at the first of chapter 10, Jesus has a group of 70 that he gives miraculous powers to, and he gives them the ability to cast out demons, which that even shocks these 70 whenever they come back, but he sends them out two by two. And then they come back and they say, "Well, even the demons are subject to your name." And so they're surprised. But, and then that is not even all. Because Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 6, that there were 500 disciple brethren that Jesus appeared to after he resurrected. So, there's a much bigger group than the more narrow scope that we get from the four accounts of the gospel. Jesus has cast a much wider net out here. And so this is where this man came from. You know, he could have been one of the 70. Could definitely, I'd say for sure, one of these 500. And this 70 would be one part of this 500 that Jesus appears to after his resurrection, before his ascension, in those 40 days. Okay. Verse 51. Now it came to pass, when the time had come for Jesus to be received up, but that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and sent messengers before his face as they went, and they prepared a village, and they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they did not receive Jesus, the Samaritans did not, because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem. Okay. Now, I finally got a time frame. I've been wanting all the way through the book of Luke to get a timeline, an estimation of where we are in Jesus' ministry. And Kaufman, nor none of the three commentators gave me anything, whereas Kaufman did a very good job in Matthew that would give somewhat of a timeline. You know, we're 1 year into his ministry, we're a year and a half, we're 2 years, we're 3 years. Well, he finally did. Both he and J.W. McGarvey are thinking that we're 3 years into the ministry. We are 6 months away from him going into Jerusalem to be sacrificed. So they both commentators felt like that we're right now we're in the September-October time frame, and then he's going to be crucified toward the end of March. So we have about 6 months. So he's 3 years into his 3.5-year ministry, which now this 3.5 years, Kaufman gets that from the book of Daniel on this 70 weeks prophecy, whereas the last week the Messiah will be cut off midway, and each day being a year, so instead of 7 years, it got cut off midway, so 3.5 years of his ministry. So that that's where he gets this 3.5. So then that we would be 3 years into the ministry, lack about 6 months from this point. Okay, so obviously, Jesus does not go straight from Samaria right to Jerusalem. He still has 6 months. And we know from the other accounts of the gospel that Luke does not include, he also goes to Perea. And from that account, Kaufman felt like that he spent about 3 months in here. But what Kaufman's explanation is about this statement here that Jesus has set his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem, that is ultimately where he's headed, but he's making preparations and he's wrapping up his ministry and making preparations for this ultimate destination to Jerusalem. But first, he's going to go to Perea. He's going to spend something, at least travel through here in Samaria. It sounds like, even though they're not welcome in this one town, the way it's kind of left is, well, they were probably welcome in another. But very likely Jesus is laying some foundation right here. But I'll go ahead and read here what the sons of thunder reply and what their thought is about this. Verse 54. And when his disciples, James and John, so this is Jesus' first cousins, saw this, that the Samaritans in this one village rejected and would not let them stay there, they said to Jesus, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them just as Elijah did? And also as God did with Sodom and Gomorrah?" That's what they're ready to do. Well, I tell you what, you rejected Jesus, Instant death. We're going to just wipe you off the face of the earth right here. Well, Jesus has a much more tempered reply. So I'll go ahead and read that here. Verse 55. Jesus turned and rebuked them, not the Samaritans. Jesus has patience with them. And this patience is going to pay off. I'll mention here in a little bit. But he turned to them and he rebuked his first cousins, James and John, and said, "You do not know what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." Jesus is laying the foundation for his plan of salvation here, and for the foundation for his kingdom. And no, this is not the time to just instantly destroy and wipe people off the face of the earth. We're going to be very patient, as Peter later tells us, 2 Peter 3, that God is very patient. Why? Because he wants all men to come to repentance. Okay. Now, obviously, and they went to another village. So the way it's sounding, this other village was much more receptive than this one. Now, what we do know about Samaria and these Samaritans, that Jesus, here 3 to 8 years, maybe 5 years into the future from this time, after Paul starts persecuting the Christians, all the Christians leave Jerusalem except the 12 apostles. And Philip, the evangelist, also leaves Jerusalem. And he comes up here into Samaria. But he gets a completely different tone than this one village that James and John wanted to destroy. They welcome him with open arms. They are very receptive to God's message. And it excites Philip so much that he sends word down. And at that time, Peter and John both come up from Jerusalem to Samaria. And they baptize many of these Samaritans. And many Samaritans become Christians. So, John, what Kaufman's comment is that John sees that patience was here in the future, something like 5 years into the future, he sees and realizes then, well, boy, Jesus was correct that it was much better that he used restraint and did not destroy these people, because looky here. Here we laid the foundation. Jesus laid the foundation for his kingdom, and now they're very receptive. And this is not the only time. And this is where Kaufman feels like this statement that Jesus has set his face for the journey to Jerusalem, but he hasn't gone straight. He's kind of meandering here and tying up maybe loose ends. Well, Samaria. He's getting them prepared, and when the kingdom has come and in the correct time, they are receptive. He's already made the foundation for Tyre and Sidon when here, probably within the last 6 months to a year of this time frame, he leaves the Galilean area and goes up here to Tyre and Sidon and spends some time here and performs miracles with these historically wicked city and these pagan people. And boy, does it ever pay off, because here in the neighborhood of 30 years into the future, Paul comes off of his third missionary journey. He lands right here at Tyre, and guess what? There is a congregation of the Lord's people, and he stays a whole week with them right here at Tyre. So that has paid off. He goes over to this pagan land of these Gentiles over here at Gadara, at Gergesa, cast out this demon, the demons out of these two men that they call themselves Legion, the demons do, And so, even though the Gentiles rejected him at that time and kick him out, request or demand that he leaves, and Jesus does, he's very patient. But guess what? After he gets off of this excursion to Tyre and Sidon, and then there's 4,000 people that follow him back down here to the northeast of the Sea of Galilee, and then Jesus feeds the 4,000 of these Gentiles at that time. Then he comes right back down to this Gergesa, the Gadarene area, where Legion had been terrorizing all of the people. And guess what? Had a little time go by. Who knows what time? 3 months? 6 months? They are receptive this time, and Jesus heals many people and obviously does a decent amount of teaching. So he's laying the foundation right here toward the end, not only with the Israelites, but also with Gentiles. And also now, Kaufman's thought about these 70 is they're probably here in this Perean area, and he's sending them out to these Gentile areas. That's his thought, that they're working these Gentiles pretty well, working them pretty heavy. And this is just laying the foundation for the kingdom. And we know that once God opens up the kingdom to the Gentiles, even though it's always going to be a minority and the path is straight and narrow and there's only few that are going to find it, but they are receptive, and there's a good number that are receptive, even though it's a small percentage of the total population. But these are all things of laying the foundation for the kingdom. Okay. Verse 57. Now it happened as they journeyed on the road that someone said to him, "Lord, I will follow you wherever you go." Now, where is this? From the context, this sounds like it's in Samaria. And maybe that it is, because we're not told where this is. But these probably are not Samaritans. Probably he's gone over to this Perea. And I haven't gotten this from Kaufman yet, but I found another website that I mentioned last week that thought that the next 9 chapters, all the way to chapter 19 of Luke, are all done with Jesus right here at this Perea, this Perean ministry. And so, in my mind, that's what I kind of feel like. There's 3 men that come up to Jesus, and these would be then Israelites, because this is Israelite territory, even though they're on the far side of the Jordan. And so, they would... that's where these came from. And instead of being the Samaritans, that would have caused problems for Jesus here at this time, because the Samaritans were still a hated people. And now Jesus is going to tell them, still this parable, Luke covers it, the parable of the Good Samaritan, to try to soften this hatred and soften their hearts and not be so hard against these Samaritans. And Jesus has already laid some groundwork previous to this with this woman at Samaria, the woman at the well. And a great number of the people came from the village, and Jesus was able to teach them. So he's laid lots of foundations in lots of places here for Israelites and Gentiles alike. So, but these are probably, what I feel like, probably from the Perean area, and these are Israelites, and not Samaritans, even though it sounds like it could be from Samaritan. But the key phrase probably in verse 57, now it happened as they journeyed on the road. So they moved on further. And since we know that Jesus spent time right before he went to Jerusalem in Perea, that's probably more where he is. But this first man said, "Lord, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. So what he's telling them is, telling this man, this is going to be a nomadic lifestyle. And it's going to be traveling all over. And since, and that obviously is not what that man wanted to hear. And so even though it's not said, it's implied, well, he dropped off because of this. In fact, three men are going to come to Jesus, and Jesus is going to give all three explanations, and they fall to the wayside because these are more difficulties than they're willing to take. And Jesus knows that, so he's helping them count the cost before they get into it, which is another teaching that Jesus had in Matthew. Count the cost and know what you're getting yourself into before you do this. Just like a builder counts the cost, knows how much material he's going to need, knows how much time, knows the expenses, and before you start to build a building. And just like in an army, when you're going to fight, you need to count the cost. You need to know what the enemy, how many they have. You need to know how much you have, and you need to have yourself well supplied before you go into battle. So that's what he's helping these three men do. Verse 59, then he said to another, follow me. But this man said, Lord, let me first go and bury my dad. But Jesus said to him, let the dead bury their own dead, but you go and preach the kingdom of God. That's obviously what was much more important. But from the way it's left, that's not what this man wanted to hear. And so he falls by the wayside. Verse 61, and also another also said, Lord, I will follow you, but let me first go and bid them farewell who are at my house. So bid my family farewell. But Jesus said to him, no one having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. So Kaufman's comment about this third man was, Jesus did not ask of anyone else to do something that he himself did not do himself. And he had already left his family. He had left his mother. He left his brothers and sisters. So he'd already left his household. He'd been gone from them for right at 3 years, 2.5 years, something like that at this point. When he left Nazareth, he left his family. So he's not asking any of these disciples to do anything that he has not already done. And now, as far as what brought to my mind about looking back after you started is with Sodom and Gomorrah, when Lot and his family were leaving Sodom and Gomorrah, God told them, you leave and you don't look back. And unfortunately, Lot's wife did, and God instantly punished her by turning her to stone. A pillar of salt. And so Jesus has the very similar teaching that God had some 2,000 years previous to this, that you need to look forward, look for the kingdom, don't ever look back. And why is that? Well, you get distracted, you slow down, you get off track. So you just look to the kingdom and you just keep going forward and keep pushing. And so the way it's left, that is not all these three teachings are not what any of these three men wanted to hear. And they probably did not follow Jesus. Hopefully they did, but the way it sounds, they probably did not. Well, we will end there, and Lord willing, we will start with next week. I'm sorry.